Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am your host, Randy Sutton. We've got a really good show for you today. We've got some really important topics to discuss. Got an interview with a great guy and a police story. And unfortunately, we have three end-of-watch memorials. Let's take a walk over to the briefing room.
The briefing room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
We talk about current events in law enforcement. Today, there have been some pretty startling things in law enforcement that I want to talk about. The first thing I want to talk about is I'm very disappointed in the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Sotomayor, who, in a dissent opinion regarding a search and seizure issue involving law enforcement. Well, let's talk about that first of all. The search and seizure issue is seen as a win for the police in that a police officer made a stop on an individual who was walking out of a drug house. And during that stop, it was discovered that he had a warrant for his arrest, a traffic warrant. When he arrested him on the traffic warrant, he found methamphetamine and some other narcotics on him. And the guy appealed his conviction because he said there was no reasonable suspicion to stop him. And this went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the police, saying that even though the stop itself might not have been legal, it didn't cross a threshold that it made it something that would stop the conviction. And so this is seen kind of as a win for the police. So Chief Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent opinion, she didn't agree with it, she gave this blistering dissent. Now, keep in mind that the individual who was arrested was white. And in her dissent, somehow, she made this into some type of weird racial issue. Let me read some of the couple things that she said. The white defendant in this case shows that anyone's dignity can be violated in this manner. But it's no secret that people of color are disproportionate victims of this type of scrutiny. For generations, black and brown parents have given their children the talk, instructing them never to run down the street, always keep your hands where they can be seen, do not even think of talking back to a stranger, all out of fear of how an officer with a gun will react to them. She went on to say that we must not pretend that the countless people who are routinely targeted by police are isolated. She continued, they are the canaries in the coal mine whose deaths, civil and literal, warn us that no one can breathe in this atmosphere. And she went on and on. And basically what she did was she turned a rather innocuous arrest of a white person into a racial issue that simply did not exist. And so what I find really disturbing about this is that she's a chief justice, or she's a justice on the Supreme Court of the United States. If she harbors this kind of bias, where she is going to read into a situation like this and basically accuse law enforcement of plotting the deaths of citizens and saying that the police are targeting people of color, where she gets this from, I don't know, but I find it very disturbing. And unfortunately, this has been shown more frequently in cases being brought before higher courts, where we are seeing these type of attitudes on display by justices and by prosecutors. Talk about prosecutors. We had a major victory this week, a major victory in Baltimore. As you know, Marilyn Mosby, the arrogant state's attorney for the city of Baltimore, brought to trial six Baltimore police officers in the death of Freddie Gray. She has, this was after her famous statement at the time that she made the decision to charge the officers, where she was basically claiming to be on the side of the people who were burning down the city of Baltimore. She made this very inflammatory speech where she made the decision to charge the officers. Well, anyone who has heard any of the evidence in this knows that there simply is no case. The police officers that have been brought to trial so far, and there have been three. The first trial ended in a mistrial because the jurors could not vote to convict. And then the next trials and this one all ended with a not guilty verdict. So this particular trial was the trial of Officer Goodson, who was tried for the murder charges involving the death of Freddie Gray. And the judge ruled that he was not guilty. This is a major win for law enforcement. It's a major loss for Marilyn Mosby. And the interesting part about this is that five of the police officers out of the six have now sued Marilyn Mosby for defamation of character. And let's hope that they succeed and that they destroy her life just as she tried to destroy theirs. Richard's got a quite a pedigree. First of all, he is an active duty law enforcement officer. He's got 18 years of experience, but besides that, he is also the writer for Guns and Ammo and the co-host for a television show, Handguns and Defensive Weapons, on the Sportsman Channel. So he is an expert on law enforcement and weapons. And Richard, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Randy, for having me. Much appreciated.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Well, before we get into the new book that you wrote, if I were to ask you, what is the number one issue on officer safety that you can identify today?
Yeah, that's a great question, Randy, and there's so many ways I can go with that. But what I specialize in and what I really think is the biggest need right now is extreme close quarter fighting. In other words, using your pistol in extreme close quarters or negating a threat in close quarters where maybe the suspect is trying to grab your pistol. And I say that because there's a lot of training in more traditional shooting methods when you have a nice sighted fire, extended arms shooting platform from the 15-yard line, for instance. But there's not a lot of training for, you know, you're fighting with a guy who suddenly presents a deadly threat and you need to use your pistol, or perhaps someone is on top of you, you're on the ground, you need to get to your pistol because you're about to be choked into unconsciousness or beaten into unconsciousness. So really, that's an area that has really suffered from a lack of knowledge, quite frankly, by a lot of police instructors. And it kind of falls in this gap where the firearms instructors aren't really very proficient with it and the defensive tactics instructors aren't really proficient in it, and both kind of point their finger to the other guy to take care of that problem.
You know, that's interesting. If you were to look at some of the really, really high-profile officer-involved shootings, such as Darren Wilson's shooting of Michael Brown in Missouri,
Sure.
Would training like you are talking about, would that have aided him?
You know, I like to think that it would. I mean, I think that he probably reacted fairly appropriately as it was, based on the facts that I know. Of course, there's a lot of it that I probably am not privy to. But that is a perfect example of a situation where you're talking about a deadly force encounter, and even though the suspect is not armed, the suspect is reaching for the officer's pistol. And you know as well as I do, Randy, that there's no way that we can allow a suspect to win the fight or gain control of our pistol, because it's not only our life that is then on the line, but it's our fellow officers as well as the citizens that we are obligated to protect. So we absolutely must have the ability to retain possession of our gun, and that may involve using deadly force, as in the case you mentioned.
Oh, absolutely. Let me ask you this. You know, we've seen a number of police officers, the number of police officers killed by firearms this year has gone up pretty dramatically.
And that was 36%, Randy, the last I heard, and it may unfortunately be even higher than that now.
That's a startling statistic. And even though we are hearing, you know, I read a newspaper article that was actually not too long ago, where they talked about that this was that actually police officers are safer today than they've ever been. And I cringed when I read that. And you realize that this is part of a, you know, I don't want to say a leftist conspiracy, but there's truly, you know, people are trying to negate the dangers facing law enforcement. So when we try and push forth real officer survival training, they're facing this political backlash.
Absolutely. I mean, even like the militarization of police, right? That's a big thing that's thrown out there. And people don't see a need for that until there's a situation like occurred in San Bernardino recently, where you had, you know, armored personnel vehicles that blocked in the suspect vehicle, and ultimately they were able to stop the threat. But that's a situation where suddenly the leftists or the liberals who are usually not in favor of that, they can even understand the need for quote military, you know, type equipment and how that is needed by today's law enforcement. You know, the threats that we face now are greater than I think they've ever been, certainly in the 19 years that I've been a police officer. There's more ambushes that are occurring every year, and this is a long-standing trend. The most deadliest distance for cops is 0 to 5 feet. That's what we call the kill zone. I mean, because in that zone, you have such little time to respond, even to perceive, you know, a deadly threat, much less respond to it. We all know, you know, the Tooler drill developed by Dennis Tooler, which is not a 21-foot rule like a lot of, you know, misguided instructors like to point to. But what that did show is that a suspect can close distance very quickly. In that case, they're talking about 21 feet. So you can imagine inside of 5 feet how quickly things happen. That's why you have to have some default responses that will put you ahead of the curve.
You know, I couldn't agree more. But there's so many other factors that are coming into play when it comes to police training. Now, you've been a police trainer for how long?
I've been my department's lead defensive tactics instructor since it was actually 9/11/2001. Coincidentally, was the day I started my 2-week school. And I've been a lifelong martial artist, but that was when I became an instructor for the department. And then 2005 is when I became a firearms instructor for the department.
So you've been in this game a long time. And you know, I read recently, and I got to tell you the truth, man, I had to take my blood pressure meds. When I was reading the new 21st century policing guidelines that have come out recently.
Yeah, PERF. Yeah.
And I read it and I was just I was shocked by the fact that police leaders could actually put their names on this thing.
You know, unbelievable.
When you read it, what were your feelings when you read it?
You know, Randy, it's funny that you asked that because at the ILETA conference in Illinois.
Well, before our listeners, the ILETA is the International Law Enforcement
Educators and Trainers Association.
Right. So correct. You were at that conference.
Yeah, I was at the conference teaching a course on close quarter gunfighting to include weapon retention and weapon disarming. It was not a live fire course, but a defensive tactics type course. And Masad Ayoub, who I've had the good pleasure to know from doing some of the television stuff that I do, asked me to be a part of his Deadly Force panel, and I was absolutely humbled by some of the people that were on the panel that I was on there with them. But I got to speak about a portion of the PERF guidelines, which relates specifically to their edge weapon recommendations, which are completely asinine. I mean, you can tell that the people that developed those guidelines had no practical experience and did not consult with anyone who did. They did not consult with line-level cops, nor did they consult with police trainers, because what they're asking officers to do is something that's physically, it's not within the capabilities of a human to do. And so at the same time, they're calling for greater deliberation. In other words, they're wanting officers to consider how their use of force will be viewed by the public. You know, again, we go back to that 0 to 5 feet. That's always the deadliest distance for officers. So how much time do you have to deliberate in that type of a situation? You have to simply respond. And I would also argue that there are many times in an officer's career where he or she would have been perfectly authorized to use deadly force. But you know as well as I do, Randy, the last thing a police officer wants to do is to kill a suspect or to use deadly force. Of course, nowadays, we are so hesitant in many cases already that it's getting us hurt and it's getting us killed. I'm sure that's the case. A lot of the police officers that are being injured or killed, I guarantee they're thinking about, am I going to use too much force? How is this going to look? How is it going to be perceived by my department? Will I be sued? So all this stuff. But going back to the specifics of edge weapon defense, they're talking about not treating an edge weapon as though it is as deadly as a firearm. And there's studies out that show the lethality of an edge weapon is almost identical to that of a firearm. So to think that an edge weapon is any less deadly is crazy. Now, there are some situations where you can use different tactics against someone with an edge weapon that would not be effective with someone with a firearm. For instance, if someone has an edge weapon, you may be able to put something like a table or something or a vehicle between you and him, and that would prohibit him from being able to reach you or contact you with that weapon. You know, whereas if you do the same thing, you know, just putting a picnic table between you and someone with a firearm doesn't do you a lot of good.
Right.
So there are some different tactics you can use. And hey, if there's a SWAT team and you have lethal cover, in other words, you have officers that are armed with patrol rifles or SWAT carbines and handguns, then yeah, it's not a bad idea to have a less lethal option, such as less lethal munitions or a taser. But that is not what you use. You don't use a taser against someone who's armed with a deadly weapon like a knife. That's just crazy. And the last thing, I know I'm on a tangent here, but this just, again, it drives me freaking nuts, is they are advocating the use of a plastic shield, like, for instance, a riot-type shield that's going to be in a supervisor's car. And or maybe they're going to be issued to all the police, depending on how you look at it. But so officers are going to be hesitant. Oh, I don't have my shield. You know, what if I shoot this guy? And then even if they do have the shield, it doesn't take, you know, a Filipino knife guru to know that all you got to do is, with your offhand, move that shield aside and thrust that blade into the officer's neck or vital organs. It's what they're recommending is going to get officers killed without question.
Exactly. That was my interpretation as well, and there's a lot of other people. You're probably familiar with Dave Smith and Betsy Smith, and you know, we had a very long discussion about this, and he is about as passionate as you are when it comes to, you know, officer safety. I mean, God knows how many police officers have saved their own lives or the lives of their partners because they received the proper training.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just one thing, Randy, to follow up on that, because I told you I just want to keep firing away at this. There is some expectation that when someone has a knife, that police are to give this subject room, give him distance, try to verbally defuse it. Well, absolutely, we will try to do that within reason. But we have an obligation to protect the public. And let's say it's in a busy area. We cannot allow this suspect who's crazed and armed with an edge weapon to just go roaming free. We are obligated to put ourselves between that suspect and the citizenry that we are sworn to protect. So to assume that we can just give this person, you know, room and time to wander is absolutely ludicrous. You know, plus, you're giving him an opportunity to create a plan at that point.
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I want to talk about one particular case involving an edged weapon that really is very high profile and still has touched a nerve on a lot of people. It took place in San Francisco. maybe 7 or 8 months ago, there was a suspect who had an extensive criminal history, got released from prison, did a whole bunch of dope, stabbed one person, and then was walking down the street after stabbing him. People called the police, and the police officers confronted him. I'm sure that you're familiar with the case I'm talking about.
Sure, sure.
The officers, they tried low lethality rounds. They tried everything to stop this guy. And he basically wanted to break out of the small containment area that they had him in. And it was all being videotaped, of course, as everything else is, by a passerby. And they wound up having to use deadly force and shoot him. Now, I don't know if you're aware of the fact that the city of San Francisco, the government, has named a day of remembrance in his honor because of the fact that the police officers killed him.
Yeah, I mean, that's,
I'm sure
that's,
you, I mean, as a police expert in use of force, I'm sure you saw that video. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, let me speak to a couple things, Randy, related to that. One is that as a result of that, San Francisco Police Department was issuing, they may have already been issuing, but they were advocating the use of a long wooden baton, like a riot baton, to be used against suspects armed with edge weapons. And again, I can't say that that would never be an effective strategy, but for that to be your primary strategy is absolutely crazy. I mean, that's going to get officers killed. That's an ineffective way to thwart an edge weapon threat. You need to have a firearm if someone is armed with an edge weapon, period. And secondly, from that, there was this recommendation. I don't know if it was formal or not, but that San Francisco police officers fire 2 rounds and assess. Again, absolutely crazy. You cannot arbitrarily place a number of rounds on how often an officer should fire before assessing. You're going to fire as many rounds as you think is necessary to stop this imminent threat that you're facing. To say that you have to stop and assess after 2 rounds, nuts. Now, you may stop and assess after 1 round. That's ideal. But if someone's charging you with an edge weapon, you may dump an entire magazine into that person before you have time to stop and assess.
Exactly.
So it all has to be, you know, based on what's reasonable at the time. You can't set these. What these PERF guidelines are trying to do, Randy, in a nutshell, is they're trying to make a higher standard than Graham versus Connor, which is the established reasonable officer standard, but yet they don't say what that is. So the danger with these PERF guidelines is that it's going to be outcome-based. In other words, in close quarters, if you get a call that this guy's armed with some kind of a weapon, and you get there and he makes a furtive movement and he thrusts his phone out at your face as though he were holding a pistol, and you shoot the suspect, they want to say, you're wrong. He was only holding a phone. That is an inappropriate and excessive use of force.
Right.
Would you know as well as I do that we are not superhuman? We can't determine if it's a phone or not. All we know is that what we're told in the call, he's potentially armed. He makes a furtive movement for his waistband, which is the most common concealed carry location. Then he thrusts a metallic-looking object toward our face, and we're going to react. If we wait for final confirmation that that's a cell phone, then we're going to be shot if it's not.
Exactly. And I'm afraid that what we have seen with all these societal changes and the and these demands by even institutions like PERF, who, of course, you know, were basically Obama White House stooges, if you will, they are now going to cause police officers to, in the face of deadly danger, hesitate and become victims themselves. And that's what frightens me the most.
Absolutely. And then, you know, I've talked to you previously off the air, Randy, about, you know, the PC term of using guardian to describe a police officer versus warrior. I mean, when I was growing up as a cop, I started when I was 24 years old, it was a warrior mentality. You are to have a warrior mentality because police are warriors just as a soldier is a warrior. So it's not a negative thing, but it's being made to be viewed, again, it's by this crowd that, you know, police are too militaristic, they shouldn't be warriors, they should be guardians. Guardian is not necessarily a derogatory term. A guardian is noble, right? You mean you're protecting someone.
Exactly.
But there is a time, in my mind, when I'm not a guardian, I'm a warrior. And if I'm on the ground and a suspect's trying to take my gun to kill me with it, I'm not a guardian. I am a freaking warrior, and I'm going to fight until I'm able to stop that threat. I am not going to allow, under any circumstances, while I have a breath in me, a suspect to disarm me so that he could then shoot me, shoot my partners, or shoot someone else. I will die fighting him, and that is a warrior mentality, and that is not negative, and that is not oppressive. That is what we need from our law enforcement protectors in society.
I couldn't agree more. Unfortunately, the political correctness that's been taking place has been diminishing that. Now we're seeing it in police training all over the country. I mean, there is in the Northwest. It was a major police department, either Seattle or somewhere in the Northwest, where instead of teaching that warrior mentality, they're asking police officers to go out in the woods and practice yoga and become more conscious of themselves instead of trying to learn the tactics that will save their lives.
Sure. And you bring up a good point. I mean, as a martial artist, and granted, I haven't practiced traditional martial arts in years, but that's how I was raised as a martial artist ever since I saw The Karate Kid, right, in 1985.
You're dating yourself.
I can relate to that mentality, and there's nothing wrong with that. And quite frankly, oftentimes, using less aggressive language is a good tactic, right? So you don't jack the suspect up. I mean, as a new cop, you know, you get in some fights and stuff, and if you want to fight, you can get in a fight every night. You know, jack some guy up, talk him up, make him fight you, then your knees are skinned up and your uniform's ripped and everything else, and you learn pretty quickly that, hey, man, maybe I should do like these older guys are doing and try to talk the guy down. It's not that big a deal, brother. You got a little warrant, turn your hand around, put your hands behind your back, you know, that type of thing. But there is a time when that is completely ineffective. There is a time when you tell someone, get the F on the ground now, you know, and that's worked more often than not for me. I read a great article by, I think it was Dean Scoville years ago, called Profanity as Verbal Judo. And how true is that? Verbal judo, of course, you know, I'm Officer Nance with the such and such police department. Is there anything I could say or do to get you to, you know, sign this citation or whatever? But profanity works pretty darn well sometimes, especially with a lot of the people that we deal with. You know, when you give a loud, clear verbal command and throw in a couple choice words, it tends to make these people understand that you're serious.
But you know what's interesting about that? I mean, you're preaching to the choir on this one. But as a police lieutenant with Las Vegas Metro, I was, of course, an advocate of saying exactly the same thing as a trainer and as a supervisor. But I found that when profanity was used, even though it was used appropriately, when that complaint came into internal affairs, they opened this investigation up like it was a major criminal investigation because they dropped the F-bomb a couple times telling the guy to put his hands behind his back.
Sure. And I've had that. I've had supervisors who are on both sides of the fence there. When I was a new cop, I actually worked in Arizona I can say it. I don't work there anymore. I work for Phoenix Police Department. And I was chasing a suspect that was that committed a domestic violence crime. And across a busy street, you know, I almost got hit by a car. He almost got hit by a car. Chasing the guy, I'm screaming at him. And I tell him, I'm going to shoot you. I didn't have the authorization, nor did I have any inclination to actually shoot him, but I figured if I told him I was going to shoot him, maybe he would comply. I'll be damned if he didn't assume a prone position, and we took him into custody.
Yes.
My sergeant said, you can't yell at this guy and say that you're going to shoot him. What if some citizens heard? And I'm thinking, whatever, Sarge. I mean, he's in custody, you know. So, yeah, I mean, and I had another sergeant that said, I think that's a great tactic. I would go a step further and tell him, you know, I'm pretty new. I think I could shoot you. I'm not sure, but I think I'm authorized to shoot you. So, yeah, it could go both ways for sure. And I certainly wouldn't recommend, you know, pulling someone over and saying, hey, listen, MF, or I stopped you because you ran that stop sign. I mean, of course, I'm talking about in a situation that's high stress where you're trying to establish, you know, some control over a situation that's already out of control.
Exactly. You know, I want to talk about police training for a moment here. I was shortly after the Tamir Rice shooting in Cleveland, where the police officers killed the 12-year-old with the toy gun. Just out of curiosity, I went into their training, the post police officer standards and training commission, training standards and training hours that are required in Ohio, and I was startled to learn that you only had to have 2 hours of training per year to retain your certification as a police officer.
Yeah, that's amazing. And to make matters worse, Randy, I can assure you that training is probably more of a qualification than it is a training. And that is a huge difference, because when you're doing a qualification, all you're doing is demonstrating proficiency. And that's not learning. That's rehashing at best, or reviewing. Learning is when you should be adding on to your basic skill set. And that doesn't happen a lot of times in modern law enforcement, because agencies become entities in themselves. In other words, they become their own island. So they don't often bring in outside trainers with a different perspective on things. And so training, even at a very large agency that you may think is very progressive, can stagnate, and it could be the same things being rehashed over and over and over.
One of the things that that I've seen, you know, throughout my career, is that every single state and every single municipality within those states have a different approach to their training, both their investigative training, all total in-service training. But what has really concerned me is that there has been a deviation in the last couple of years because of the, quote, softer policing movement, you know, that's been kind of put forth by the president and others. And we are getting away from training officers to survive armed encounters.
Brother, you hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, so much of what we teach at an agency, and again, I'm with a Northern California agency, we're making strides now. But for the longest time, we spent 90%, and I don't know if it's exactly 90%, but we spent the vast majority of our time training to handle someone who's either non-resistant or moderately resistant. The proverbial drunk, you know, at the bar on a Friday night who's not being combative, doesn't really want to escape, but just is sort of uncooperative, kind of pulling away. Well, those are situations that people can deal with. Cops will figure out how to deal with that. But what we give our officers precious little training in is someone who is trying to kick their ass, or someone who's trying to take their gun. And those are, I forget who said this, but it's on point. The high stress, low frequency, or high liability, low frequency, whatever it was, like a gun disarm, like someone who tackles you and wants to pummel you, you know, like you're the loser in a UFC fight or something like that. So you have to prepare for those, and those are what we as law enforcement trainers do the least to prepare our officers for, what they need the most. It's easy to teach someone, you know, here's a control hold that will allow you to apply handcuffs. Yeah, but try to apply that control hold to someone who's trying to either A, get away, or B, you know, use force against you. In other words, actually trying to beat you up. That's something that we don't prepare nearly enough for.
Exactly. You know, before we're kind of running out of time here, but I want to talk about your new book. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. It's called Gunfight, An Integrated Approach to Shooting and Fighting in Close Quarters. And my goal with this book is to give someone who, you know, maybe a shooter, and they may know some self-defense. They may be a police officer that has some defensive tactics training, but they don't maybe fully understand how to connect the dots between those two disciplines. And in close quarters, like I've mentioned previously, there's no distinction between a shooting and a fight. It's all one event. So you need to be A, able to retain possession of your gun, and B, know how to use your gun in that extreme close quarter environment. I'll give you one quick example. We train oftentimes that when we're drawing our pistol, our left hand will come to our chest, because from that position it can easily join in the grip as we're driving the gun out to our target. The problem is, at that 0 to 5 feet distance where we're most often killed, if you put your hand on your chest, you're going to get run over. You're going to get pummeled. You don't have the luxury of having your offhand staged to receive your gun. You're going to have to use that offhand to drive it up under the suspect's chin to drive him back to create distance, or maybe he's swinging something at you, whether it's an edge weapon, a fist, or whatever. You may have to protect yourself with that offhand as you're bringing your gun into play if it's a deadly force type situation. So that is where I was going for with that, as well as giving officers responses for the things that we talked about earlier, the things that aren't happening to us every shift, but if they do happen, it could be the end of our life if we don't have a simple gross motor base solution. So I certainly don't profess to have developed everything in here. I have a lot of good mentors that I borrow from and give attribution to, guys like Kelly McCann, former Special Operations Marine, Sergeant Major Kyle Lamb, Masad Ayoub, Lieutenant Colonel Grossman, Jim Cobber, who's a former Navy SEAL, Dave Spaulding, who's a mentor of mine. All these guys, they've been so helpful to me and shared their knowledge selflessly, because we all have the same goal, which is to make cops and also the citizenry safe from those who would harm us.
So where can people get your book?
You know, they can get it on Amazon, and it's available either for purchase as a soft cover book or as a Kindle book. They can get it from my website, which is WARTAC, WARTAC.com, and also from the publisher's website, which is looseleaflaw.com.
That's great. You know, is that strictly for police officers? Or
no. No, it's not, Randy. You know, it's made for concealed carry folks, people that have a firearm in your home. I mean, if you have a firearm for home defense or self defense, this book is good to have. You need to be able to retain your gun. This book will show you how. We talk about things that are really helpful, regardless if you're a police officer or not. Being close to someone who makes a furtive movement, you see their elbow rise, they start reaching for someplace along their waistband. What can you do immediately to place yourself in a better position and buy you time to draw your gun or to start making your escape if you're unarmed? So really, it's a book that bridges the gap between shooting and fighting. A guy can have 15 books on shooting. I think there's still a place on his shelf for this book because it fills that niche.
That's great. Richard, thanks so much for appearing on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much, Randy. Keep up the great work, brother.
You got it. I surely will.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
Welcome to the Police Story segment of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. As you probably know, on each show, I feature a story written by an active duty or a retired or a former police officer about something that affected them on the job. A war story, or it could be something that that had a great emotional impact. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different, because I was contacted by the wife of a law enforcement officer, a police officer. She said that she's been listening to the show, and she had written a story about something involving her husband. And if I would be so kind enough to read this story, and even though it really doesn't fit with the normal criteria, I think it's pretty important, because the spouse of a police officer is their support system. And I don't think we hear enough from them or about them and the important role they play in the role as a role in the life of the active duty service officers. So I would like to read this story. It's by Dawn McCarty, and her husband has been a police officer for 18 years. I want to share a story with you, a story that happened to me and my husband. Yesterday, my husband had a really bad day. It was one of those, why do I do what I do? And what does it really even matter sort of day. Our conversation about his day even went so far as me telling him that I would fully support him in any decision he made, even if it meant leaving the department. So needless to say, it was not a good day at all. He didn't need to go into detail. He didn't need to, and I didn't pressure him to provide any. Whatever happened to him that day was wearing on him heavy, and it hurt my heart to see my usually strong rock of a husband spiritually crushed. To try and ease the tensions of the day and to put his, our minds elsewhere, we called up some friends and made plans for dinner. Once dinner was done, we made our way home. We pulled into the driveway when I saw a couple and their 3 or 4 year old boy coming back from our neighborhood park. We knew them, so they stopped and chatted a bit. The little boy then pointed to my husband's patrol car and asked if it was his. He answered yes, and I asked my husband if he had any of those police badge stickers or stuffed animals that he carries in his trunk. Of course he did, and he motioned the boy to come over to his car and gave him a few stickers. The boy went on to ask about the lights and the sirens, and as I stood back and watched my husband and the boy interacting, another family walked up with their 3 children. They also had a young boy, probably about 2 years old, and he wanted to see the woo-woo police car. So my husband was talking with the other 3 children and passing out stickers and answering questions, taking turns letting the children turn on the lights and the sirens. The smiles on the faces of those kids and the laughter worked their way into my husband's heart, and I could see the familiar light in his eyes returning slowly. I stood back and just watched, and my heart swelled with joy, love, and pride in my husband, in what he does, and who he is as a police officer and a man. I also heard loud and clear the voice of God. He was showing me, us, my husband, the answer to his questions that day. He showed my husband why he does what he does and why he continues to do it. It's not for the brass or the co-worker that's not pulling his weight or the child he couldn't save or whatever was weighing on him. These moments, these little moments, this is why he does it. He does it for the children he can reach and for the positive influence and change that he can and does make. God heard my husband's heart and his silent prayer. Perhaps it never escaped his lips, but his cry was heard and answered in the way it needed to be. There have been days since that when my husband comes home disheartened and down. However, he never has forgotten that day and the little reminders of why he chose the profession that he chose. If you have a police story that you would like read on the air, please feel free to send it to me at Randy Sutton at America Out Loud.
End of watch.
Each week on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we talk about the lives of the officers who have been killed in the line of duty during the previous week. Unfortunately, during this week's end of watch, I have 3 officers who gave their lives. Police officer Zachary Larnard of the Gainesboro Police Department in Tennessee. His end of watch was Wednesday, June 15th, 2016. He's 26 years of age. He served for 5 years. The cause of his death was an automobile accident. Police officer Zach Larnard died as a result of injuries sustained in a vehicle crash. He was responding to a domestic violence call when his patrol car left the roadway and went down a 17-foot embankment. Rescue crews were able to extricate him after 2 hours and transport him to a local hospital, but he passed away. The second officer who lost his life in the line of duty, Sergeant Stacy Allen Baumgartner of the Patton Village Police Department in Texas. His end of watch was Sunday, June 19, 2016. Sergeant Baumgartner was killed when his patrol car collided with another vehicle. He was involved in a pursuit at the time. The impact pushed his patrol car into a light pole and caused the other vehicle to overturn. He was transported to the Memorial Hospital, where he succumbed to his injuries. He survived by his wife, son, and daughter. Our third end of watch is Deputy Sheriff David Michael Jr. of the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office in Louisiana. His end of watch, Wednesday, June 22, 2016. Deputy Sheriff David Michael was shot and killed while making a subject stop near the intersection of Manhattan Boulevard and Ascot Road. A struggle ensued during the stop, and the subject was able to pull a handgun from his waistband. He opened fire on Deputy Michael, striking him several times, and he continued to shoot him even after he fell to the ground. He was transported to the local hospital but succumbed to his wounds. Deputy Michael had served with the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office for 9 years, was assigned to the Street Crimes Unit. He is survived by his wife and his father. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, where each week we tell you the unvarnished truth about law enforcement issues. We bring to you stories about what's going on in American law enforcement, and I hope that you enjoyed this show. You can catch it each week on AmericaOutloud.com.